Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Bridewell against Eberle. Mr. Fire.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court, Kurt Foyer on behalf of the appellants Bridewell, Rhodes, and Manuel. We have a number of issues in this case, as Your Honor knows, and I think our primary argument is with respect to the issue of probable cause in this case to arrest each of the three plaintiffs. And I believe it's clear that the district court did not evaluate all of the facts pertaining to whether there was probable cause or draw all the reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiffs from those facts and did not conclude that there was no, or that no reasonable jury could find for the plaintiffs. The district court took the opposite tack, which was to say, well, it wasn't unreasonable for the police officers to assume that this could have been a murder as opposed to either a suicide or some kind of, given the highly inebriated state of Mr. Chandler here, perhaps he accidentally shot himself. But we think.
But you certainly will agree that probable cause is an objective determination, right?
Of course, yes.
And similarly, that it has to be evaluated as events appeared to the police officers at the time.
Absolutely. I mean,
they didn't know at the time, for example, that he was inebriated.
True.
How could they have known that? And finally, that even if it's iffy, there's this idea of even arguable probable cause. We're not going to sit here in hindsight and second-guess what they knew.
Well, in terms of that phrase, arguable probable cause, I mean, that to me that's kind of a, maybe a loaded phrase is the wrong term, but that's a phrase that I've seen used in some of the case law in terms of qualified immunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I can certainly address that now if Your Honors wish, but just to kind of back up a little bit in terms of the actual basis for probable cause. What we're arguing is that based on the facts known to the officers at the time these plaintiffs were under arrest, the facts certainly weigh more heavily in favor of a reasonable officer finding that this was a suicide or a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And in particular,
but you don't have to, probable cause doesn't require a preponderance of the, like a more than 50% chance, right?
It does not, but
so why don't, you know what would be helpful for me? If you kind of ticked off what you think the facts were that were known to the officers as of the time they make the arrest.
Sure, and we have in our brief kind of put that in a separate section, mm-hmm. but in terms of the highlights, and these are also facts that the district court did not consider and that the defendants have omitted from their brief in terms of their analysis of probable causes, you've got the fact that these three plaintiffs were at Mr. Chandler's vehicle, but then according to this eyewitness Bonds, with whom the detective spoke while at the scene, the facts they knew were that Bonds saw the three plaintiffs running away from the vehicle after he heard one of them shout, "He's got a gun," which he took to mean referred to the driver of the vehicle or the person in the vehicle, and that a single gunshot was heard while these three plaintiffs were running away. And then immediately the horn of the Jeep or the vehicle sounded, and that's how the officers who first arrived on the scene found Mr. Chandler with his head slumped on the wheel and the horn still sounding. So I think, you know, those facts are strong evidence that, number one, none of these plaintiffs fired that first shot. And number two,
how does that set of facts establish that none of the plaintiffs could have been responsible?
Well, it again, this is an eyewitness who sees these three people running away, not with a gun, not having shot this person. They're running away when the shot is fired. So I think that, you know, is strong evidence that they didn't shoot this individual. Plus, then you've got the facts known to the officers that the gun that was found is in the console next to this individual, Mr. Chandler. They find a shell casing outside the vehicle, and the driver's side window is open. And the detectives testified, well, we knew that this type of gun ejects the cartridges, and it's possible that that cartridge flew out the window. And they knew, based on their own observation, that that cartridge matched the other cartridges in the gun.
But, you know, I guess what I see in this record, I'm looking at this section of your brief, the police dispatcher puts out a call that there's a threatening situation. Then there are other dispatches about shots fired, other dispatches about people running around. Somebody's identifying two possible, two men who might have been somehow involved. And timing can get confused in situations like that. It seems to me a responsible officer responding, knowing that there are shots fired, might feel that any number of people who were associated with it could be responsible.
Well, I think Your Honor is right that they had a suspicion that these people could have been responsible, but again, were there any facts sufficient to establish probable cause to arrest them for either a murder or, even though it wasn't, you know, on the officers' minds at the time, this aiding and abetting that is what the district court relied upon. But, again, the fact that...
Well, I take it you agreed with Chief Judge Easterbrook that they didn't have to be the trigger person to be involved in the murder, the alleged murder.
Yeah, and again, in terms of, just to touch back to what Your Honor had previously said, in terms of the timing of everything, the officers did know at the scene the sequence of the shots, because they also talked to the other eyewitness, Sean Waite, who said that after the initial shot was fired and the horn had sounded, several minutes later, he saw these two other unknown male individuals go back into the alley and that more shots were fired then. So they did know the sequence. And again, we believe those facts show that even if... I mean, let me back up. The one fact that the defendants, I think, can point to is that the officers believed, erroneously as it turned out, that there were three gunshot wounds to Mr. Chandler's head. That's really the only fact they had to believe that this was a murder as opposed to a suicide. But I think that fact or that belief by the officers is not reconcilable with the single gunshot wound to the head or the single shot fired while plaintiffs are running away and then the horn immediately sounding, and that's how Mr. Chandler is found. So I don't think you can reconcile those two things, and certainly a reasonably prudent officer would have waited for the medical examiner to conclude that, well, what really
but
did...
Before even detaining these people? I actually want to ask you a different question, which is how, if at all, the probable cause concept that you're arguing about affects your state law claims of malicious prosecution and intentional infliction of emotional distress?
Well, I mean, an element of the malicious prosecution is that there was no probable cause to arrest the individuals. And here I think this more goes, well, it's limited to Ms. Bridewell, for one thing. She's the only plaintiff who has the malicious prosecution claim. She was the only one who was actually charged with the crime here. But I think...
I thought your whole point about her was trying to argue that there was a question of fact why the charges were eventually null-prossed, that there was this exchange on the record about the quid pro quo for the other charges, but then there was also evidence in the state's attorney's files that indicated it was a lack of evidence. But so you're saying, though, that probable cause also factors into the malicious prosecution?
I thought that was Your Honor's question.
The only
argument that was raised, you're correct, is whether the outcome was indicative of innocence. But just to tie up what Your Honor just asked about how probable cause fits into that, with respect to malicious prosecution, that's not frozen in time as to what the officers knew at the time of the arrest. So everything else comes in all of the forensic evidence that came in after the actual detaining of Ms. Bridewell. So, you know, the medical examiner's report, the gunshot wound residue being on Chandler's hand but not on Bridewell's hand, all of that comes in to determine is there probable cause to continue the prosecution. So I think, you know, it's a different analysis and actually more favorable analysis to Ms. Bridewell than just the false arrest analysis.
Did you ever in the district court suggest that if the federal claims were disposed of, that the state claims should be dismissed under 1367C without prejudice?
That never came up because the district court judge ruled on all of the claims. In other words, he did not.
So he just you never had a chance to say, well, give us a shot at the state claims in state court, even if the federal hook goes away.
We were not given that chance. He did not solely rule on the federal claims and then put those over to the state court. He ruled on everything, the malicious prosecution, the IIED as well. But to loop back to Your Honor's question concerning the issue of was the outcome of the criminal case indicative of Ms. Bridewell's innocence, again, that's the only issue that has been argued before this court. And we think the great weight of the evidence shows that it was, in fact, resolved indicative of her innocence. I mean,
So I understand your argument to be that there's a factual issue. I mean, you have to concede that the exchange on the record in the state court seems not to be indicative of innocence. It seems to be a plea bargain, essentially, where they're just saying we're going to package this up and the murder charges could come back, which suggests to me not indicative of innocence. But then there's other evidence. So you want to say that that exchange is just not conclusive.
Well, certainly, at best, in our view, it creates a disputed issue of fact. But I would disagree.
Well, is there some state case you're relying on for the proposition that the court should look behind the plea bargain to see whether the charge would have been dismissed anyway?
Well, I did not find a case that specifically addressed that, Your Honor. But, I mean, the case law does say
something of a problem for you?
I don't believe so, Judge, because the case law does say that in viewing whether the outcome is indicative of innocence or not, you're to look at all of the facts and circumstances, and there's no contrary case law saying because there was this exchange on the transcript on the record.
The state court keeps saying that charges dismissed as part of a plea bargain are not indicative of innocence. And then it seems to me you need some state case saying exception. You can look behind the plea bargain to see whether the prosecutor would have dismissed it anyway.
If
no state case says that, as I say, it seems to me you're swimming against a current here. And I come back to my colleague's question. One wonders why this state law issue is in federal court. You really need some change in state law in order to succeed on it. You need some state court to say, look behind the plea bargain. Federal courts don't make innovations of state law.
I don't think we get there, Judge, because I don't think the record on which the defendants are relying shows there was, in fact, a plea bargain. There's a passing comment by the judge that he assumes that this is part of an agreement with respect to both cases.
And they say, yes, it is. And then they follow up a little bit.
Well,
I mean, it's not the most elaborate Rule 11-like process, but that's not important.
Well, there's nothing with respect to what this bargain was, and there was, in fact, an agreement, but it wasn't like a bargain for exchange in which Ms. Bridewell gave anything up or said, you know, I'll accept a guilty plea with a sentence for time served on these separate gun and drug charges if you dismiss the murder charge. What happened and what the evidence shows, as we've set forth in our brief, is that the state came to Ms. Bridewell's counsel and said, we're going to drop the murder charges. We're going to reduce the gun and drug charges to a misdemeanor, and we'll recommend a sentence for time served. They didn't ask her to give up anything. They didn't ask her to bargain for anything.
Well, what about the sentence? I mean, I didn't see anything here. I guess I can ask the state that, too. But I don't know what the maximum possible sentence was on the drug charges, but there's this comment she makes. I happen to be looking at the red brief, page 15. She says she understands she could move to vacate her plea, but if the court granted the motion, the case would be reinstated, including the original class 10 drug charge. The murder charges will be reinstated, and everything will be set down for trial. So the state gets the benefit of wrapping things up, and she gets the benefit of a potentially lower sentence. Isn't that classic?
Well, but again, like I had mentioned earlier, there is no quid pro quo or bargain for exchange with respect to the state dropping the murder charges, and we've got this memorandum from the ASA on the case who says, I sat down with Anita Alvarez and we reviewed the evidence and we're going to nolly this case because we can't carry our burden of proof here. So that was basically just presented to the defense counsel that we're going to drop the murder charges, and of course he's not going to dispute that. He's going to agree with that. So to that extent, there was an agreement, but it was not an agreement that one could call a plea bargain. He didn't have to say anything but yes. She didn't give up anything. There was no bargain for exchange, as I said, of...
She gave up something. She pleaded guilty. She has a conviction on her record, an extra conviction on her record. She gives up the right to seek damages for wrongful prosecution on the drug and gun charges.
Right,
I mean,
but...
What, I don't understand it when you say somebody doesn't give up anything by pleading guilty to crimes.
Well, in that particular case with those particular charges, the gun and drug charges, yes, she did give up something there. But again, that's a separate case and separate charges.
You give up something, they give up something.
In that case, with respect to those charges. But there's nothing
but
that says...
The packaging happens all the time. You know, there'll be several charges pending, sometimes from the same indictment, maybe sometimes not, but one of the more serious ones gets dropped.
Well, they were packaged in the sense that both cases were being heard at the same time for the sake of economy. But again, they were separate cases. They were separate, unrelated charges to each other. And there's no, you know, link other than that between the dropping of the murder charges and her plea to the separate gun and drug charges. Again, there was no agreement by Ms. Bridewell that, well, I'll plead to these separate gun and drug charges if you drop the murder charge. That didn't happen. The state dropped.
Didn't the trial judge note that if Ms. Bridewell vacated her plea, quote, the murder charge would be reinstated?
Yes. But again, how is that indicative that there was some kind of quid pro quo deal of...
Well, why, I don't want to speculate where we shouldn't go, but why would the trial judge say that?
Again, I don't know, Judge. I'd be purely
speculating
on that.
I'm just wondering what he or she is drawing from the dialogue that went before.
Well, you know, the judge was obviously making an assumption here, but there really wasn't any dialogue about it. It was just the state saying, that's correct, Judge. There was nothing on the record about, is there a deal, what is the deal? And therefore, we don't think that that record itself establishes that this, the dropping of the murder charges was part of any plea bargain by Bridewell. I do see my white light is on here. I will rely on our briefs for the rest of the issues, but I'll reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal, unless the court has any further questions at this point.
Certainly, counsel. Ms. Masters.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Here are the facts facing Detectives Eberle and Farbrook on the evening of September 3rd prior to any Fourth Amendment seizure by them. Chandler hit Rhodes' vehicle and left the scene of the accident. Rhodes and the other plaintiffs, along with Anthony Watkins, chased Chandler into the alley and blocked his only apparent exit. At least some of them are seen at Chandler's vehicle. Rhodes, the other plaintiffs, and an eyewitness give varying accounts of a shot or shots fired. There's a report of one eyewitness of hearing somebody say he's got a gun. Some of them are seen running in the alley, but there's not a report that they're all seen running in the alley. Another eyewitness reports that 2 to 3 minutes later, two men enter the alley and take additional shots at Chandler's SUV. Chandler is dead by apparently 3 bullet wounds to the head. His SUV has bullet holes in it. There are bullets and shell casings laying on the ground near the vehicle. This morning, I will explain that these events gave rise to probable cause to believe that the plaintiffs had been involved in Chandler's homicide, or at a minimum, the detectives had qualified immunity. And I'll also address malicious prosecution and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Now, just briefly on the probable cause, I'd make a few points to the court. First of all, counsel is focusing on this one witness who says he's got a gun and people are seen running from the vehicle. There are varying accounts told to the officers of how many shots are fired and who is seen running, but the point we would make to this court is that the main reason it appears that the district court judge believed there was probable cause, and what one of our major arguments is that because there are two additional men who come to the alley and fire shots. Now, whatever one might think about whether that the impact of that first shot, he's got a gun, there's a shot, people are seen running, that's the focus of their argument, the focus of why this was suicide. Let me make a few points. First, clearly officers have no idea whether that first shot is fatal.
Can I just interrupt and ask you, some of this information comes to the officers' attention through various dispatches, as I understand it, as they're on their way to the scene. And is some of it the result of interviewing people once they get to that alley? Or is it all the dispatch? I'm just trying to figure out how
some of it is
filtering
the result
through.
Of interviewing people once they're in the alley, yes.
And
I mean,
is that when they find out about the extra two men, or whether they're extra or not, the two men who come in?
No, there's a dispatch also about the two men.
Okay.
And then they also get to the scene, and there's an eyewitness there, Wade, who they talk to about the two men. So there's additional men who come to the alley, and they're firing at the SUV. Now, clearly, probable cause is an amalgamation of facts, and there's I have not heard any argument that firing at this SUV is non-criminal conduct. And clearly the officers are allowed to believe, again, as the district court found, that it would simply strike them as incredible that moments later two men come to the alley and are firing additional shots at the SUV, and it has nothing to do with a hit and run with Rhodes' vehicle, nothing to do with the fact that Rhodes has apparently, by her own vehicle, blocked these people, blocked Chandler in the alley so he can't escape. And so,
that's what I'm concerned about. What links these shots and these two men to Bridewell, Rhodes, you know, who seem really just to be trying to get out of there to their mother's house, I guess. Aren't they? Don't they call 911 at some point?
I think there's a report that Rhodes' mother maybe had called
911. Maybe it was the mother, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, and I think there's a report about the hit and run that gets made to the police as well. But the bottom line is that the police are allowed to look at all of the facts and to use their common sense. And no doubt it strikes the police as incredible that somebody, after this confrontation with Rhodes, has simply taken out a gun in the alley and shot himself. That's really not a plausible explanation of what happened. And in the meantime, you have Rhodes and the people who are accompanying her involved in the confrontation, and then minutes later you have additional shots fired. And they were certainly entitled to believe or find that there was probable cause, that something a reasonably prudent officer could have believed, that those additional shots were the cause of death, or at least inflicted injury, given that they were to the head, and that was probable cause under Illinois' accountability statute to find that all of three of these plaintiffs were involved in a homicide. And if not a homicide, at least other unlawful conduct. Because probable cause, this is the other issue we take with plaintiffs' argument, probable cause doesn't have to be specifically that there was some homicide committed. It's a criminal conduct. And they clearly had probable cause to believe there was criminal conduct. In the least, they had qualified immunity to believe there was arguable probable cause. Moving on, if the court has no other questions on that, to malicious prosecution. The malicious prosecution charge was brought, the malicious prosecution charge is as to Bridewell only. as the court was discussing with counsel, she enters a plea, and the terms of the plea are set forth in the transcript. It involves dropping the murder charge by, according to the terms of the plea, in exchange for a plea on the drug and gun charges. Now, Judge Wood, you asked a question about maximum sentences. I don't recall a maximum. I know in our brief the change in the drug charge leads to a reduction in the minimum. So she's charged with a Class X felony for possession with intent to distribute cocaine that carries a 6-year minimum. She pleads down to a Class 1, which carries a 4-year minimum. Now, this leads and then, of course, on the record, she's also, there's the nulli of the drug charge, and the judge says, I assume that's in exchange for the plea on the drug and gun charges. The state says yes. Nobody corrects the judge. He then instructs Bridewell, the murder charge is coming back.
The nulli on the murder charges, you mean.
Right,
she
correct.
She gets the lower class on the cocaine charge. One of the gun possession charges goes away, and the murder charge goes away. And that's a big charge to give up. And so my question for you as well is, you know, I can certainly take this exchange that happens in the circuit court as evidence rebutting any presumption that may exist that taking a nulli is indicative of innocence. So here it's, you know, there's discussion of a bargain. But what I'm interested in is whether this is conclusive evidence, whether this is rebuttable evidence. What kind of evidence is this?
Well, and under Illinois state law, the cases over and over again state that a plea is not indicative of innocence. Now, I don't believe that there are
right,
any
cases.
Right,
and I'm certainly putting that in the non-innocence column, but I want to know whether that's rebuttable in some way.
And the answer to your question is there does not appear to be a state law case on point as to whether it can or cannot be rebuttable. So our argument is it shouldn't be rebuttable because of the nature of pleas, because you're standing before a judge, the judge is confirming the terms of the plea, you're agreeing to the terms of the plea, and she is agreeing that the murder charge can come back. Now, if that is not what she should be agreeing to, or what she wants to agree to, then the time to do that is at the plea bargain. It's not to come in and in a later proceeding collaterally attack it and say, oh, no, actually, the terms of the plea, I mean, literally, her lawyer's affidavit, her criminal lawyer's affidavit, it's different than this counsel. In this case, he's saying, well, it didn't matter to me what the judge assumed the terms of the plea was. I mean, that clearly cannot be correct. It matters
right.
greatly.
No, her argument essentially is the state was giving up nothing when it dropped the murder charges because it knew it couldn't prove them anyway. So she was getting, in a sense, a bargain by getting her drug charges reduced as they were. But the state was never going to be able to do anything with the murder charge anyhow. That seems to be her theory.
Right, but the state still is preserving its right here. And we don't, I mean, the transcript speaks for itself, is our argument. And our argument is under Illinois law, to date, there's no case setting an exception to
and
that.
There's no other state, I mean, it's kind of a cure. It must come up in other courts.
Well, interestingly, given that this Evans case is cited in the IID discussion, the intentional infliction mm-hmm. discussion before this court, the facts of Evans do talk about how the plaintiff had pled guilty to some charges and others were nullied, and he initially had a malicious prosecution claim, which he lost on at summary judgment and then doesn't appeal it. So it comes up apparently, but it doesn't seem as if there's been a resolution either in this court or it's ever squarely been addressed in state court, although, again, the state court repeatedly just reiterates this. It's not indicative of innocent statement. But putting that aside, we have other arguments, and another problem with the plea is that she agrees to serve this sentence and serve all of this time in jail.
Well, she'd already served it, right?
Right.
She serves, like, 3 more days.
She does, actually, she gets released the following day.
Okay,
but,
so.
Right. Yeah. But she, that eliminates her malicious prosecution damages claim because she can't claim that she's damaged by her time in jail awaiting trial when she agrees to spend that time in jail.
You're Why is that the only source of damages? Why isn't emotional distress, attorney's fees, other elements of damage still there, even though certainly the confinement damage is addressed?
Well, in this case, we... let me point out one major issue is they state in their brief that we did not argue damages before the district court, and we did. It's at R92 at 15, which is our summary judgment memorandum. And they responded to our damages argument that there were no damages because of the sentence, and that's at R103
at 14.
So what did
you say? What exactly did you say?
We said there were no damages because of the sentence served, and their response was, there are damages because I wouldn't have pled and because I served 10 months longer. And our response is, that's speculative. You can't say that because maybe you wouldn't have gotten this deal at all from the state had you not been in jail. But beyond that, we make those arguments about that it's entirely speculative. And there's a statement in her brief that... we have other damages, and then she doesn't identify what they are. So this was briefed before the court, and she doesn't identify what other damages were she could proceed on, and so we think that there's a waiver argument. But at any rate, a huge element of her damages claim is certainly eliminated.
Right. I mean, but I just can't believe that it's all. Now, whether she needed to say, I had emotional distress and attorney's fees and maybe nominal damages or other sorts of things, I'll just have to look at those record references. But... it strikes me that if you're talking about malicious prosecution, it would be more than simply standing, you know, sitting in jail for 1,057 days.
Well, I think certainly theoretically that could be true. Our point here is it wasn't raised when she had the opportunity to do so, and it's, okay. And it, that argument was clearly raised below.
So what about the intentional infliction of emotional distress? I know you've made the argument that it's time-barred, but she's asserted a continuing source of actions, each of which has inflicted emotional distress. Is that independent of all this probable cause stuff, or is that somehow tied in somehow dependent on the circumstances of the original arrest?
Your Honor, we believe it is independent of the probable cause for the following reasons. Because her theory, and it's set forth, I think, on page 29 of her opening brief, is that the intentional infliction charge is based on, or the intentional infliction claim is based upon three factors. It's the allegation that Detectives Eberle and Forberg supposedly continually failed to tell the state that Rhodes's and Watkins' statements implicating Bridewell were coerced. Mm-hmm. It's their purported withholding of exculpatory evidence from the crime lab, referring specifically to one thing, these DNA swabs from the gun. And it's Detective Forberg's refusal to supposedly cooperate with prosecutors reviewing the evidence later in the case. Now, we read those as having nothing to do with probable cause to arrest.
Okay. I mean, I think I do too, but I just wanted to make sure because I wasn't... clear talking to the other lawyer.
And our argument on those issues is that they're simply unsupported by the record. They have failed to create a genuine issue of material fact as to any of them. The videotapes, Detectives Eberle's and Forberg's interrogations are videotaped. The state's testimony is they watched those interrogations on the video either contemporaneously or shortly after they occur. There is no evidence that anything was withheld.
And they do show a pretty awful set of tactics.
Your Honor, we have not disputed what is shown by those, but our point is the state views it, and the state goes ahead and makes a prosecutorial decision based on what they have seen. Their argument for malicious prosecution, I mean for intentional infliction of emotional distress, is we hid something from the state. Now, whatever could be said about the substance of what happens during those interrogations, it's not hidden from the state. So on that's
But if the DNA is withheld, does that come out in the interrogation? I didn't think it did.
DNA is not withheld. There's no basis for the claim that that was withheld. A lot forensics evidence is submitted to the state ISP lab within a few days of its being collected. There are some swabs from a gun that unfortunately were not submitted at that time, but
until 2009, right?
Correct. So but there is absolutely no evidence in this case that was adduced to show the reason for that. And there's because of that. And because of cases like Arizona versus Youngblood, first of all, they're not allowed to assert it would have been exculpatory. We don't know what it would have shown,
no,
but they certainly can't claim it would have been exculpatory. But to the intentional infliction claim, they can't show intentional infliction from that. They don't know why it was withheld, but they're not certainly entitled to the assumption it was done on purpose, particularly in light of the fact that all the other evidence is timely submitted. The final point that they relied upon is Detective Forberg's supposed, it's not supposed. He does not speak to the state when an ASA contacts him to discuss the evidence in this case. Now, that can't be a basis of intentional infliction either, because what he's doing is remaining silent, but he's remaining silent when the state has all the evidence. So he's not, what could he do? He could go in and express his own opinion on the evidence, but their claim is he should have gone in and said that his behavior was coercive. Well, again, the state has those interrogation videos. They can make that conclusion, but it's not an intentional infliction if nothing is being withheld from the state.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. You have to say it's not an intentional infliction if they're not doing something that harms her, you know, somehow. If Forberg is manipulating the system in such a way as to inflict severe emotional distress on her, then that's what that tort's all about. If, in fact, nothing he does adds anything to whatever the distress was to begin with, then perhaps nothing has happened.
Well, and right, to Your Honor's point, they don't have any evidence that the fact that he won't speak to the state adds anything, given that they have the evidence and they can make their own evaluation. So in terms of timeliness, the argument that we engaged in any new or continuing conduct is simply not true. What the detective's conduct happens in the fall of 2006, and there's nothing that makes this claim timely when it is brought in 2010. There's no continuing actions by them that cause intentional infliction, and Illinois statute and case law, and as this court noted in Evans, is quite clear that you need continuing conduct. If the panel has no other questions, I do want to just briefly mention there's some issues about extended detention claims. Bridewell clearly waives any extended detention claim by the time she gets to her reply brief and states, I have not brought a separate extended detention claim. She states in her reply brief at some point, though, that Rhodes and Manuel have extended detention claims. We would suggest to the court that that's waived. She did not adduce any evidence as to when Rhodes and Manuel were processed or when they could have been brought for a Gerstein probable cause hearing, so she has no record that anything untimely happened in this case. Instead, it does appear her argument is they were falsely arrested, and her extended detention just appears to be an element of false arrest, but if there's probable cause to arrest, there's no extended detention claim, which is based on the timeliness of a Gerstein hearing. So if the court has no other questions, for the reasons set forth today and in our briefs, we ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, counsel?
I'll try not to talk too fast, but I do have a number of things I'd like to get to. Starting with the intentional infliction of distress argument, the record does, in fact, show continuing violations by these officers. And, in fact, the refusal to submit some of these samples for DNA testing didn't occur until after this lawsuit was filed. So I think clearly with respect to that, we're within the statute of limitations period.
But where does the intentional element come in with that? That certainly sounds, if anything, negligent.
I think the intentional element comes in, Your Honor, is because right after these plaintiffs were taken into custody and the forensic evidence did start coming in, for example, the gunshot residue evidence, the medical examiner's report that there was a single gunshot wound to Chandler's head, the more forensic evidence came in, the more it went against whether any murder took place here. So I think the inference is reasonable to make that these police didn't want to submit any more forensic evidence because everything that came in was going against them. So they just stopped submitting it. And what other explanation is there for the state crime lab not getting these samples? They were logged into evidence by these detectives. They were the ones responsible for getting it over there. So I think there's clearly misconduct within the statute of limitations period. And the state's, defendant's argument here is really that this misconduct is excused by the fact that the state's attorney's office decided to charge. But we've cited the Jones versus City of Chicago case that I think clearly establishes that officers are not excused for their misconduct by a subsequent decision to charge. And with respect to the duration...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now.